3. The Sermon on the Mount and the Five Commandments of Freedom. It is surprising to encounter Jesus' five commandments if one has only been aware of the Ten Commandments of Moses. When meeting seekers on a new spiritual path, my experience is they do not want to have those commandments again. The old way of dictating truths from above is still fresh in their memory. Naturally, everyone is free to search for truth as they see fit. Truth is one, but there are many paths to truth, as the saying goes. It is a paradox of the spiritual path that the way to freedom passes through voluntary discipline. Like any true yoga, the yoga of Jesus aims at liberation. This is indicated in his epithet, Savior. Let us look at his statement, "The truth will set you free," John 8:32. What is the truth then? Jesus himself provides an ambiguous answer. "I am the way and the truth and the life," John 14:6. I cannot think that Jesus means that his teachings are irrelevant in pursuing liberation. Nor can I understand that mere faith in his death and resurrection will save us. It is inconceivable that this kind of belief, holding a certain proposition as true, could decide the eternal destiny of a human being. We who believe in him and follow him are required to do something as well. Jesus didn't give his teachings to no avail. He demands something from those who follow him. It is our task to grow and go forward in the path of wisdom through the five commandments. The truth value of Jesus' sayings and promises are tested in the exercises prescribed by his yoga. Does he speak the truth? And does the truth really set us free? Let us reflect upon what prevents us from being free, and upon what we should be free of. As I have already mentioned, in his book Astral Schools, Ervast defined 3 great problems from which we should learn to liberate ourselves in this earthly school: poverty, ignorance, and sickness. Avoid anger. Jesus says in his first commandment, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.' But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raka,' is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell." Ervast has crystallized this teaching into this form: do not get angry. Getting angry, or losing one's temper, is usually a quick burst of emotion, a rapid reaction to what someone does or says. In many cases, this burst discharges the energy in us. And when we observe it, we notice that the energy was just waiting for the discharge. If we observe ourselves in a state of anger, we start to see how its mechanism works. We begin to identify the reasons or roots of why we lose our temper. Usually, these reasons stem from ignorance and lack of wisdom. We are unable to penetrate deeply enough to the reasons that cause us to lose our temper, nor are we able to think of the consequences of our anger when we are immersed in it. Sometimes the anger and resentment can linger within us, even after a bout of losing our temper, acting as a seed for hatred, on which we dwell for a long time. We are then caught in an emotional trap. Hatred is a long-term form of anger. The Swedish-Finnish poet Elmer Dictonius has said that a person can never understand what he hates, as understanding is always underpinned by love. There is a well-known saying that rage is blind. Blindness and lack of understanding are often synonymous in Jesus' sayings. When we give in to anger, we drive ourselves onto a path that seems to have only one way of proceeding, violent reaction. By contrast, learning how to be calm is a step towards measured and reasoned reaction and communication. Developing consciousness and understanding helps us see the roots of anger and work them out for ourselves. This work begins with a practice of remaining calm. Talking about avoiding anger sometimes raises a question posed by people who have read their Bible. It is related to a story in which Jesus, apparently in anger, drives money changers and vendors away from the temple. A common question is, why did Jesus get angry in that situation? If we are practicing the yoga of Jesus, we must read the Bible in a meditative way, not as a fairy tale or textbook on history. We must try to penetrate beyond the words and find a more profound wisdom. Jesus presented his teachings in the form of parables, partly because it is easier to remember a teaching when it is given as a story. Could it be that the scene from Jesus' life could also be allegorical, thus leaving room for different interpretations? It is possible to open Holy Scriptures using many keys. Paul tells us that our body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, 1 Corinthians 6:10. The yoga of Jesus aims at bringing discipline, at a moment of exaltation, to the experience that the Christ is within us. At that point, the Christ has entered the temple of our own spirit, and the unholy features within us vanish. In that light, we clearly see what in us doesn't belong to the temple. Jesus performed a powerful symbolic act in cleansing the temple. When the Christ enters our temple, the truth enters at the same time. It lights our consciousness with the light of love, which is also an uncompromising light of truth. Truth is a unity. The selfish pleasures of life have no part in the temple in which the truth prevails. The temple is a holy place, and there can be no commerce in it. I cannot think that the Christ within us would get angry with our lower passions or misplaced thoughts, represented by the vendors and money changers. A flash of fury and a flash of truth may appear the same, but they are two distinct things. I suspect that various scribes throughout the history of Christendom confused the flashes of truth and fury. Could this be due to the wrathful and cruel image of God portrayed by some parts of the Bible, especially the Old Testament? Cleansing the temple is a decisive action in which Jesus' consciousness cannot be dimmed by anger, not for a moment. On the contrary, his actions are guided by crystal clear deliberation. As Ervast indicates, Jesus' first commandment states that we should not get angry in our hearts. Our external actions can be forceful, our saying and doing can be decisive, yet our conduct is in strict inner control. Violence is the external manifestation of anger. Like hatred and anger, it is blind, and its essence is a perversion of real power. It is based on the use of physical force to threaten or coerce. The person wishing to have real power will eventually realize that it is spiritual in nature, reflecting genuine authority. That kind of power presupposes the capacity to rule over oneself, that is, controlling lower feelings and desires. When we start to practice the yoga of calmness, that is, not getting angry, we notice that our consciousness changes and grows. Eventually, we will realize that there is no reason to get angry or feel hatred. This path enables all of us to do our share in reducing violence and conflicts in our surroundings. The history of anger and hatred is so long that unlearning it could easily take a whole lifetime, perhaps many lives. However, this is a crucial lesson, and unlike harboring hatred, it will keep us on the path. Avoiding anger can be taken as a daily yoga practice. It is not an easy lesson, but every step forward is rewarding, manifesting itself in enhanced self-control, as well as in a gradual release from the grip of negative emotions. A truth seeker who practices the yoga of Jesus has the task of observing himself calmly in a state of anger and pondering upon why he is angry with his brother. For a Christian, everyone is a brother or sister. In situations that give rise to anger and hurt, what are other possible ways of responding? When practicing this form of self-observation, it is possible that one will get angry at one's own anger. But the reaction of anger cannot be vanquished by force or coercion. Instead, we can calmly learn to see what the origin of anger is, what lies behind it, and what it does to us. There should be no violent attitude towards it. Learning how not to get angry is, in this respect, closely connected to Jesus' fourth commandment, which states that one should not resist evil. The psychologists are correct in saying that one should not confine or suppress anger and hatred, as nice people tend to do. Often, these experts say we should express our anger. It is said that anger and a good fight clear the air, but this is not what we are addressing here. In fact, keeping long-term anger inside is not healthy for us. In this situation, the person who doesn't understand his anger tries to control or contain it, or just lets it erupt. The person who consciously aims at outgrowing anger is in a different position. The same principle applies to being offended. Actually, being offended often occurs alongside anger, or is its milder form. It usually works in a reflexive manner in us, and always betrays something about our character. We often are offended by something that is not meant to be offensive in the first place. I will not go further into the psychology of being offended. Instead, I will share a teaching I learned from a friend. I've thought about this for a long time. We keep on being offended as long as we want to be offended. Do we want to be offended, or do we want to understand why we are offended? We begin to see more when we learn how to control our tendencies to be offended and get angry. Control does not come through smothering, but by working to deeply understand these feelings and the factors related to them. We begin to become free from the patterns that have chained and blinded us. This emotional burden is often acquired at home, possibly transferred from one generation to another in our families and culture. The bright side is that it is possible to put an end to this chain. Parents of small children have a good practice ground for avoiding anger. One often tends to become upset with small children. It is very easy, but if you are striving to educate yourself, you can make genuine progress by dealing with them. Ending the chain of anger fosters a nonviolent and peaceful atmosphere. It also promotes holistic health by strengthening our etheric being. In this way, it diminishes one of the great obstacles to human liberation, disease. Like everything in the yoga of Jesus, learning not how to get angry is learning to love. It liberates us from disease and ignorance. In addition, as Ervast states in The Divine Seed, we begin knowing others' thoughts, even though no words are uttered. The person who has learned to keep his thoughts pure will learn to see others' emotions, to see their energy bodies, that is, their auras. Keep your thoughts pure. In his second commandment, Jesus addresses the relationship a person has with one of the strongest drives, sexuality. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." To the modern ear, this commandment sounds austere, but essentially It is about upholding purity in mind and thought. The same aspiration is found in all forms of yoga, and it is not limited to sexuality. Pekka Ervast has crystallized this maxim in the following form. Do not be impure, even in your thoughts. According to the Genesis story, human beings were divided into two sexes during the ages after the world and other beings had already developed. He created them male and female, Genesis 1, 27. Human beings, divided into two sexes, received an inner force of attraction, a driving energy, a creative ability, God's potential in us. As an attractive force, the sex drive is related to reproduction and hence to the survival of our species. In its higher forms, this creative energy manifests itself in artistic propensities. In people who have reached a higher level of development, sexual energy is refined into the energies of the purest love and creativity. These different but intertwined possibilities arise out of the same basic source of energy. These energies are accompanied by sexual pleasure, which is manifested at different intensities at various phases in life. This passionate pursuit sometimes provides pleasure and sometimes, in a cyclic fashion, frustration. In any event, the person who is striving for a higher life must pay the utmost attention to the questions in this domain. The sex drive is a natural, life-supporting force in the animal kingdom, whereas human beings, in the course of their evolution, came gradually to emphasize its pleasurable aspects. At this point, the pleasure has become detached from its original connection. Over recent decades, huge industries have been built to promote and stimulate urgings toward this type of pleasure. On the one hand, we embrace our addictions, and on the other hand, we try to liberate ourselves from them. A person may understand freedom as unrestricted license to satisfy his passions, but is he really free, or just a slave to his desires? Drives, pleasures, and passions originate from our unrefined past. They reflect our way of reacting to these forces we have nurtured in ourselves. This is the animal within, although animals do not have addictions in the same sense as humans. Actually, we should talk more about a primordial primitivity, which is based on a selfish hunting for instant pleasures. This is always accompanied with some sort of suffering and remorse. Nowadays, sexuality is presented to us more and more detached from its natural surroundings, that is, love. It has become for many a drug-like pleasure, in which loving interaction has been diminished, if it has not vanished altogether. In this case, love, which is always about giving, turns into its opposite. Sometimes a person in the grip of passion is willing to sacrifice everything to get satisfaction. It is easy to develop a strong addiction to sexual pleasure. I recall from a school psychology lesson an experiment in which rats learned how to stimulate their pleasure centers in the brain. Eventually, they forgot to eat and died of hunger in front of the lever that provided the stimulation. Let us think of the five commandments in the Sermon on the Mount as maxims of life that bring us towards freedom. In this light, we can interpret the second commandment as follows. We should observe our thoughts in the same way as in the practice of not getting angry. We do not force ourselves, but we draw our attention to what is more important. We focus our thoughts away from desire and addictive factors and toward love. In this commandment, Jesus does not address sexuality per se. Rather, he addresses our attitude towards sex. He teaches us to listen to our heart and act wisely in the riptide of the strong energies of love. The yoga of Jesus, like others, emphasizes controlling the mind. Mind is the crazy monkey that must be calmed down in order to allow the higher consciousness to take charge. This yoga entails the daily monitoring of thoughts and practicing the ability to distinguish the essential from the non-essential. This critical approach teaches me to question which aspects of my emotions are true and enduring. Am I just being driven by my lower instincts and desires? When we meet others, our sense of responsibility grows little by little. We ask how I should react to another person, and in what way I should love him or her. Practicing in real-life situations provides a measure of our status in the path. This practice invites us to a closer interaction and to a closer sense of communality, which seems to be elusive today. Indeed, we find our real humanity in relationships. Mere analytic deliberation easily leads to mechanical choices, bookish puritanism. Admittedly, there is the danger of repressing sexuality. Hence, it is worth remembering St. Paul's statement, "For it is better to marry than to burn," 1 Corinthians 7:9. Yoga requires determination and self-discipline, but the right action arises from the right thought, not from force. None of us means that we should reject the physical aspect of love as morally inappropriate. There is no such thing as inappropriate in the traditional sense. The individual is free to think and will. But Jesus is calling forth a growth of will in us. In the yoga of Jesus, one seeks for real freedom, in which no one and nothing, let alone lower desires, chains us or drags us down. When the thought life is gradually purified, the student begins to pay attention to what is purest, most beautiful, and valuable in her feelings toward the other person when she loves, falls in love, and makes love. We usually want to give the best in ourselves to the person we love. We also know that after encountering another person only in the domain of sexuality, we may feel we wanted to say more. However, I do not recommend being too austere, relentless, or unforgiving towards oneself. This is resisting evil, which Jesus urges us not to do. Let us show wise kindness toward ourselves. When the ability to discern the essential from the non-essential has developed to some extent, we notice the strong bursts of emotions that unclean thoughts and images can create. These churning emotions bolster passion. When we learn how to release these thoughts without fighting them, we start achieving mental balance, a calmness which is the sign of self-control. A thought begets a deed. Pure thoughts create pure deeds. Jesus' second commandment teaches us to become free from the chaining passions of emotional life, which can even become pathological. It is not hard to imagine, for instance, that a man addicted to child pornography may have nurtured this addiction in an earlier incarnation and is unable to let go of constant lust, anxiety, and fear. Strong passion can indicate a karmic inheritance. One might think that it is impossible to reach a pure mind when dealing with the strongest human passions. As we can see, Jesus aimed at a faraway future. Every day is an opportunity to embark on a spiritual journey, even if it is for the first time. This yoga is not easy, but ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Matthew 7:7. These openings will come to us as a growing sense of inner peace and spiritual experience if we persist and do not give up when the first failures take place. Like any form of spiritual practice, the yoga of Jesus requires patience, but it also requires mercifulness and tolerance toward ourselves when we fail. The higher powers accompany everyone who follows the path of yoga. If we fail, there is always the mercy of a fresh start. Be truthful in your speech. Jesus' third commandment addresses speech. He forbids us to swear oaths. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Ervast crystallizes this commandment in this form: always speak the truth. When we take an oath, we solemnly swear that we are speaking the truth, but there is no need for an oath if we always speak truthfully. We are committed to the truth, regardless of the consequences. If we think of an explicit situation of an oath taking, for instance, a military oath, it is above all an oath of loyalty and obedience. In this situation, the oath taker hands over the power to make decisions and responsibility for his actions to others, in this case, military leaders. One promises to obey without questioning and follow orders in future situations, with no knowledge of what the future might hold. Of course, a true follower of Jesus cannot act this way. Responsibility is a part of being human. Becoming a true human being means becoming responsible. Handing over responsibility in this situation is giving up one's humanity. In discussing such topics as the army and going to war in the context of Jesus' commandments, we need to keep in mind that they are given as spiritual guidelines to individuals. The Master does not speak to states or nations. He gives his advice to his disciples, to those who want to follow him. Speaking the truth is a demanding yet simple maxim. When we speak truthfully, we don't have to restate our case all the time. Relationships between people become easier. Living in the world is significantly easier with honest people than with liars. What if we want to be honest when everybody else is lying? Admittedly, there is a risk in honesty, but there is also one in lying. Someone who doesn't speak the truth is usually attempting to gain some advantage, such as money or power, or is trying to avoid the consequences of previous wrongs or lies. Little lies, gossiping and slander, in fact, all the vices of the tongue, entangle us in a web of small chains, which are reinforced by new lies. Constant lying eventually drives a person into a corner, producing anxiety. The wisdom of Jesus, "The truth will set you free," is at its clearest in the context of the third commandment. Speaking the truth destroys the web of lies and cuts off the chains of fear. When I tell a lie now, I cannot be honest in the future, otherwise my lying will be exposed. Living in a web of lies is living in constant fear of being exposed. It is hard to breathe in such agony. Right thought, right speech, right action, says the Buddha. The purification of thought is closely related to speaking the truth. The yoga of honesty actually begins with the right thought. In his book, At the Feet of the Master, J. Krishnamurti emphasizes temperance and deliberation. It is well to speak little, better still to say nothing, unless you are quite sure that what you wish to say is true, kind, and helpful. Before speaking, think carefully whether what you are going to say has those three qualities. If it has not, do not say it. The yoga of honesty can be seen as fasting from speech, which gives us time to consider and purify our thoughts and mind. Taming the mind and speech, having them under conscious control, builds inner peace and improves mental insight. This development happens organically. When we give up the old, we receive something new to take its place. Speaking the truth develops our ability to discern the essential from the non-essential. We do not have to say everything that comes to mind. In some situations, it is possible to save lives by keeping silent. The use of reason is always advisable. All of this relates to listening as well. We don't have to listen to lies, gossip, slander, or any evil talk about others. We can cut the chain and clear the air. It is possible to stop lying to oneself and others and start speaking truthfully. It is always a daring decision, signifying that one has entered the path that leads to liberation from selfishness and self-interest using lies. It is also a step toward accepting karma. When we are honest, we are ready to accept the consequences of our words and actions. Deciding to start speaking the truth does not necessarily mean that we know the truth, but at least we are heading towards it. Speaking truthfully is the condition and prerequisite of evolution. Courage is needed because we know that the world treats the speaker of truth quite differently from the liar. It is peculiar that many are ready to take extreme chances, for instance in war or crime, but when it comes to orienting ourselves towards what is good, truth, and right, they become cowardly and incapable. Perhaps it is because goodness and kindness often go hand in hand with courage in these decisions. The world has seen, and still has, those who dare to speak the truth. Some of them have spent much of their lives in prisons. One famous example is Mahatma Gandhi, who utterly baffled politicians and other schemers by always telling the truth. On many occasions, Gandhi had to spend time in prison, yet in his actions he followed Jesus' teaching, "The truth will set you free." Gandhi said he felt that he was freer than ever when he was behind the bars. He is no doubt one of the people in the previous century who best exemplifies the commandments in the Sermon on the Mount. Speaking the truth will provide us with a spiritual backbone, alleviate fears, and bring forth both respect and self-respect. Followers of the yoga of Jesus are always truth seekers. Their strength and ability to see and deal with people, situations, and life in general grow out of truthfulness. Ervast reinforces what has been said above. Quote, "When we ask what new sense Jesus wishes to awaken in us with the aid of this commandment, in what new way we can become aware of the heavenly kingdom if we learn to control our thoughts and speech, we get this reply. You learn to see other people as they are. Within you, a new sense will awaken that will inform you what talents, inclinations, and characteristics other people possess." End of quote. Do not resist evil. Jesus' fourth commandment teaches us to regard evil in the right way. It is a fundamental question in Christianity and for humanity in general. According to the Bible, we are here as human beings to solve the riddle of good and evil. Jesus says in his fourth commandment, "You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you." Many Christian thinkers have maintained that Jesus' fourth commandment is the cornerstone of Christianity, but over the centuries, it has been the stone upon which the church has stumbled. In a way, this is quite natural for a church that has been bound up with earthly power. Had it understood Jesus' advice, it would have acted more mercifully towards those individuals who have, for instance, spent time in prison for refusing to enter military service. The liberation struggle of India, led by Gandhi, sets an example that is still worth researching further. The commandment to not resist evil is usually the hardest one to understand. It is natural to think that if we are striving for good, we must fight evil. Jesus' advice requires inner strength and integrity. When one tries to follow it, one can find oneself in the midst of external difficulties. Nevertheless, this maxim is based on the fact that, on the one hand, it is not possible to conquer evil with evil, because one evil is fighting on the same side as another evil. The two will fight each other to the death. On the other hand, it is not possible to fight evil with good, because goodness never fights. The good acts differently. Resorting to the good relies on a logic that is clearly not consistent with the present world order. Goodness comes forward, humbles itself, submits, turns the other cheek, understands, shows compassion, and loves. Learning how goodness works requires reversing the logic of the world, which is based on competition, scheming, cheater, and greater might. Even if one understands Jesus' logic intellectually, its implementation demands courage, although this is not always evident. The prerequisite for not resisting evil is controlling the mind, which in turn starts with learning how to remain calm. If a person wants to believe in the power of goodness and love despite all the difficulties, he will eventually face the authority structures of society. If he doesn't want to fight or kill for his rights, he will soon gain a reputation as a coward. Instead of fighting back, he will let an attacker hit him. Furthermore, he will be called a traitor to his country because he doesn't want to learn how to kill in the army, which has a tight hierarchy with no possibility for individual freedom. Declining to submit to the violent world order is one step in the path of not resisting evil. It is how many people choose to learn this principle in our time. In the Yoga of Jesus, the problem of evil leads us to define what is evil and what isn't. What is the evil that we should not resist but overcome? From theosophy, we learn that there is evil, but it is more inside us than outside. Lower desires and lust form the evil that keeps us away from truth. In the Yoga of Jesus, liberation from this kind of evil entails inner purification. We cleanse ourselves of desires without resisting any visible evil. It is a kind of light treatment. We concentrate on the light, that is, on the goodness within. Little by little, lower desires and bad features will wither, no longer receiving the nourishing energy of attention. It is generally thought that external suffering is evil. Cruelties, horrors, and various catastrophes and diseases that we see all around and which we encounter in our lives as well. But when we become aware of reincarnation and the law of cause and effect, or karma, we realize that this hardship is something we deserve. It is paying old debts, and its purpose is to teach us. As Ervast writes in The Divine Seed, quote, we realize that what we once believed to be evil is actually good, because it is reflective of our past mistakes. In this way, we rid ourselves of evil, and being freed from these deeds teaches and enlightens us. Feeling indebted to others will preoccupy us until the debt is paid. We would be quite ignorant if we felt indignant when paying a debt. For it is natural that stable people pay debts in order to free themselves. End of quote. Ervast's explanation forms the basis for the true Christian attitude towards suffering. Surprising as it may be, by which one is grateful for the suffering one meets. Ervast addresses another key point related to Jesus' commandments and their liberating effect. He teaches that we must balance the suffering we have caused by bringing an equal amount of love to this world. This is a way of liberation from our karma, which is not just suffering, but the way of neighborly love and loving service. The yoga of not resisting evil teaches us to react properly to suffering. It is not easy to see why someone would learn to meet violence and suffering with calm submission. However, the yoga of Jesus doesn't make us ineffectual wretches. It changes how we react to external suffering and punishment. It develops our consciousness and our ability to discern the essential from the non-essential. We begin to distinguish the times when our suffering is an unnecessary martyrdom that helps no one from the times when real sacrifice is needed. As we progress, our attitude towards evil changes. We begin to see more clearly how the law of cause and effect works. we will gain and cultivate a new attitude toward suffering. When we cease to fight evil, strength and certainty will flow into us from above. We rid ourselves of negative emotions produced by our desires to get even, punch back, and punish those who have trespassed against us. If we don't repay violence with violence, it loses its edge. It is good practice to observe situations in which people react with violence and see how those situations are devoid of love. The practice of not resisting evil nurtures inner strength and peace. These qualities will follow us into the next life. They are not destroyed by moths and vermin. All the good we have acquired in this life will be available in some form in the next life. We leave our property behind us, but these qualities will carry us into the future. Furthermore, in the Divine Seed, Ervast promises that the path of not resisting evil eventually leads us into a state in which we remember our past lives. Learn to love everyone. The commandment of love is the fifth step. It is stated in the Sermon on the Mount as follows. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. This is the most far-reaching and comprehensive of Jesus' commandments. If one could condense the meaning of life in one sentence, it could be, learn to love everyone. I believe that virtually everyone who has understood the fact of reincarnation can agree that our mission in the spiritual school of earth is to learn to love one another. Life after life, we start as children. We must receive love to live, and finally we become adults who are able to give love first to family members and then to the ever-growing circle of people around us. Loving everyone is not a mission that can be quickly accomplished by anyone, and it may seem utopian. Yet it is the final goal of our earthly school, and it is the goal towards which we must work. If we are to graduate wise and victorious, I see no alternative to this. Learning to love is seamlessly interlocked with other ethical teachings in the yoga of Jesus. Forgiveness, practicing how to remain calm, purifying the mind, speaking the truth and not resisting evil. Actually, it encompasses all the other commandments. In the first stage, loving all people means trying to relate to others with kindness, understanding, and compassion. The maxima of love is based on the ideal of brotherhood, which is the first principle both in theosophy and in true Christianity. Over the centuries, the human tendency to discriminate against people based on language, skin color, gender, and similar qualities has clouded over the ideal of brotherhood. Although it seems that we haven't gone very far in attaining this goal, a glance across history shows that some progress has nevertheless been made. The commandment of love opens up paradisal visions in our mind, and we can accept and understand them with our reason, but this is not enough. I believe that most people understand where love could lead us, yet the same people sigh in disappointment from one century to another. It's not going to happen. One person is powerless to change anything. We are never going to be brothers. Humans are selfish and weak creatures. It is beautiful, but this is how the tempter whispers in our ear. When impatience is great, the notion of reincarnation provides us with a perspective that does not end with death. It tells us that life is a school that we attend in order to become perfect. With each life, we are taught something new. One life cannot possibly be enough. But each new life offers us the possibility to learn more and grow. Our achievements are counted as victories in the next life. We can learn from our mistakes when we have an opportunity to atone for them in the next life. It is merciful to have a new beginning. The human being is, in essence, a spiritual being, who carries an image of God within, and, one life after another, learns to achieve its likeness. This is our mission. At the same time, it is the path of our evolution. Spiritual evolution takes place alongside physical evolution. The Eastern traditions speak of it as transcendence. It is being raised to a higher level in spirit and consciousness. It is growing in love. I am fully aware that this might sound utopian, but we all have an opportunity to embark on this journey, which provides us with unprecedented energy. Amidst all the chaos, it is good to keep in mind that there's a vast group of people on Earth, most of them the so-called meek, who have personally decided to find out whether the Great Commandment really is the truth and the life. When we follow the commandments, we ask whether there is a spiritual reality, and whether the yoga of Jesus opens us a door to this reality, the kingdom of heaven, and to freedom, as he promised. A truth seeker who manages to change theory into practice will experience brotherhood and love as cosmic consciousness. Then he will realize for the first time what the poet meant when he wrote the following: "He who forgets himself will have the happiness of dreams." Loving your enemy takes determination and faith. We can do it with people who are close to us. We all know people whom we find somewhat appalling. They are a good starting point. We have no need to look for enemies among hostile nations. It is worth trying to see what kindness, compassion, and love can do when one starts practicing them. Isn't it the case that the echo changes when the input changes? We can see how the person we have resented before will change and what other things can happen. Experience has taught that it is exactly these difficult people who teach us the most. My friend Jouko Ikonen, living in Kuopio, Finland, says it beautifully in his book, The 12 Keys. Love the whole creation in which you have only teachers, not enemies. Learning to love, together with other teachings of Jesus, changes us and our relationship with people close to us, to nature, and to reality as a whole. Practicing the yoga of Jesus enhances our respect for life and for all of existence. Spiritual empowerment changes our relationship to suffering and karma. Our spiritual growth is bound up with karma, the universal law of justice, which allows us to atone for our evil deeds and past mistakes. The spiritual power that guides us in this school of life becomes part of us and changes our relationship with karma and suffering. We can pay our debts to life more calmly and with a trustful mind. The will to atone becomes our inner richness and strength. It is nowadays said that love is a verb. This is true, but it is also the right attitude to have towards our neighbor. The Apostle Paul characterized love in his first letter to the Corinthians almost 2,000 years ago, and his description can still be taken as a guideline for investigating how love works in everyday life. Freedom begins from within. When we do the inner work of purification, we make space for new love to come. It gives us unprecedented strength and courage, which then flow out of us as well. This is what the Master told his disciples: "You are the light of the world." It is generally known that humans can use violent means to awaken their dormant spiritual powers. Many have looked for a shortcut to happiness from drugs, but there are no shortcuts to spiritual growth. The powers and abilities stimulated by drugs are virtually never based on enduring ethics or pure motives. Such supersensible abilities are not in the service of life. Instead, they serve the individual's selfish aspirations. In this case, spiritual powers and forces of consciousness can turn into forces of destruction, which are pernicious to the person using them. Elevated streams of energy that pass through the seeker are like intensive radiation which burns off the impurities of mind. If there are too many of these impurities, the consequences can be fatal. Spiritual teachers do not cease warning about these matters. Jesus gave his new five commandments of the Sermon on the Mount for inner life, which together with the accompanying guidelines of purity, offer a safe way of development for us. He says, "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well." The kingdom of God is, as Jesus says, within you. It is love consciousness, the divine light, which is hidden in our hearts, and which we are called to brighten from one incarnation to another. We come here to study love, the right, deeply satisfying kind of life. The journey will be long. It has already lasted for a long time, and it will continue to last for a long time. This journey requires patience. However, when we grasp hold of the light, it will constantly provide us with more consciousness and liberate energy that we never knew was in us. Pekka Ervast describes this process in the context of the fifth commandment. In The Divine Seed, he writes, quote, "Extending love and doing good acts have profound psychic influences and consequences, allowing us to see God, the Heavenly Father. Experiencing great love, which is behind everything and contains everything within itself." End of quote.